is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I've been dying all week long. I'm actually kind of hyper tonight. I'm so excited about this guest. I have Roland McCready with HeartMath Research Institute. How are you, Roland?
I'm doing great, Eva.
I've been dying for this all week long.
Okay.
So you have some... First, I guess go ahead and tell everybody a little bit about HeartMath for any new listeners.
Well, there's the Institute of HeartMath. I could tell you our mission. That might help. And that's to help establish heart-based living and global coherence by inspiring people to connect with the intelligence and guidance of their own heart. So the research center is really about researching the physiology, I guess you could say, of the human spirit, but not in a religious or a woo-woo kind of way, with real rigorous hardcore science.
What do you mean when you say coherence?
Well, coherence is, that's not an easy one to answer, but let me give you the definitions that make up what we mean by coherence, because there's really several. The first definition in a dictionary is like in a conversation or an argument someone is making, being logical and coherent, like coherent speech. In physics, it means when multiple systems synchronize and work at a much higher level of efficiency. So we mean it in both of those ways. So when what we have found is that really our emotional system that drives coherence in our bodies, or not. So certain types of emotions drive us into incoherence, meaning our nervous system doesn't communicate different parts of the body as well. It's kind of like driving your car with one foot on the brake and the other an accelerator at the same time. Whereas positive emotions renew energy instead of draining and drive the system into more harmonious interactions. And at the energetic level, there's also a type of coherence going on as well.
Just so the listeners understand, does this have anything to do with the autonomic nervous system?
Sure. The autonomic nervous system is one of the primary systems. It's a very high-level system in the hierarchy of the control within the body's systems that ultimately controls the immune system and the hormonal system and these types of things to a large degree. And it's the autonomic nervous system is the main communication pathway, the wiring system within the body that our thoughts and emotions interact with the body.
Interesting. So I'm dying to ask you, you've just finished a research project, I understand, and you've got your results in. So tell us about the project, what you did, who you did it with, and what you found out, and what it means to mankind.
Okay, I think you're probably wanting to ask me about the Global Coherence Project. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's not a project that's finished yet. That's one that's really just getting started.
Okay.
We did finish another big study, but that's a completely different topic. The Global Coherence Monitoring System, which is part of the Global Coherence Project, which is much wider in scope, is basically will be a global network of sensitive magnetic field detectors that are specifically designed to monitor fluctuations in the Earth's geomagnetic fields, but more importantly, excitations and pulsations and resonances in the Earth's ionosphere.
Now, what is the purpose of wanting to know anything about that?
Great question. And that's going to take me a little while to answer that fully, because there's multiple reasons. First, let me tell you that our partner on this is a fairly famous physicist, theoretical physicist named Elizabeth Roscher. And she's the one who really first started looking at the ionosphere in a more rigorous way. And these resonances in any way, these changes in the Earth's field, the way you could think of it. And this is different than the Earth's static magnetic field that we all know about, that we all live in. These are the resonances and the AC-type oscillations. But what Elizabeth first found was that prior to an earthquake or a volcanic eruption, there's a signature that shows up in the Earth's field about 2 weeks before the earthquake or the volcano eruption.
How does it show up? How do you know that?
Well, it shows up in changes in certain frequencies that occur.
That are measurable with equipment?
Yeah, with these sensors that I'm describing that we'll have the global network of. So that's one of the more... That's an important thing to do, but it's not our main purpose, even though that's one that will have a great service to humanity, I believe,
mm-hmm.
if we can really look on a global level and start predicting, not to the specific, exactly time and things, but if we know within 2 weeks in a certain geographical area, that'll be a very useful thing to know.
So you already know, you can tell what area it's going to be in?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. To give you an example, through the 1980s, Dr. Roscher accurately predicted not only the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington, but in the year and a half following that, they had an 84% accuracy rate in all the seismic activity in a 100-square-mile area around a single detector.
I have to ask this question. How did her peers accept her prediction?
Well, that's a whole other story, and maybe we can get Elizabeth on for a future show and let her tell you that herself.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, go back to what you were saying.
Well, that's one reason. There's a lot of work. Well, let me back up a little bit and just kind of tell you the story about this, if I may. It might make a more coherent explanation of what I'm about to say. The ionosphere, there's different levels of it, different layers, and not that, I'm having to learn all this myself here in the last year, but they're called the D region, E region, F1, F2, these types of things. And you could think of these, I've come to think of them as like the membranes around cells. It's these layers that protect us, that hold the atmosphere in and protect the Earth from all the cosmic radiation and heavy protons from the sun and these types of things. So it's, you can think of it kind of like soap bubbles. And each layer has a different consistency. They're made of different stuff, different plasmas. And each one has, therefore, its own resonant frequency. So if you can imagine a soap bubble floating through the air and you kind of poked on it, that would create waves that go out around that bubble, right? So you can kind of think of the ionosphere like that. For example, when the space shuttle takes off, and as it goes up through the different layers, kind of poking holes through it as it goes through them, it creates these resonances that resonate around the entire planet. And so we can literally see in these detectors where the space shuttle is that's going through the different layers because of the oscillations that it causes. So knowing that, we know the frequency that's associated with each layer. Making sense so far?
Uh-huh. I want to ask, can you give us some idea of the frequency ranges, just of the first couple?
Sure. Mainly they're between 0 and 500 hertz, so it's
okay.
Fairly low frequency stuff.
Right.
There's a main kind of frequency around 30.6 hertz, and then most of the stuff of interest to most people is in the lower regions, because they're in the same regions as human brain waves and human heartbeats. So that's a great question to where I was going to go next. There's a fair amount of work that's been done already looking at correlations between changes and these resonances in the different levels of the ionosphere, which is mostly, from this context, driven by solar activity, sunspots and solar flares and things like that. They shoot out all these heavy protons and things that hit the ionosphere and create a type of, you could think of it as incoherence in the ionosphere, a lot of activity. And those changes in the Earth's magnetic field have already been associated with things like changes in brainwave and nervous system activity on a mass level, affects our performance in tasks like sports performance, our ability to remember things. A lot of work, in fact, the most has been done in energetic sensitivity, the ESP experiments and things like that,
mm-hmm.
are affected. But also the plants and algae and trees and all these types of things, their ability to uptake and synthesize all the nutrition they need are directly affected by the Earth's field. That when we come into the human space, things like traffic accidents. So when the Earth's field is kind of, I guess you could call it upset, but in these more incoherent states, we have more traffic accidents, more tickets are written for traffic
really?
Violations. Yeah. The a lot of work has been done in very, very large studies because you can look kind of historically, but also there's a fairly strong correlation between heart attacks and strokes.
When these sun flares are acting up?
Yeah, in other words, when the Earth's field. So the sun flares act up, that causes change in the Earth's field, and then that is increasing fairly well correlated with heart attacks and strokes and these types of things. But also depression and suicide are correlated with it.
What frequency would that fall in? Do they know?
Well, you mean in terms of the... And I don't think they really know the frequency that's going on in the Earth's field yet. That's the kind of things we'll be able to do with the new system we're developing.
Amazing. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's all right. Please do, if you have a question. So that's one of the things we'll be able to look at when we get the global network up, is to be more specific about what layer, what frequency, in other words, of the ionosphere, are correlated with these different things. Now, what's really interesting is of all the things that, in terms of the human system, changes in the geomagnetic conditions are they most affect the rhythm of the human heart or heart rate variability, which, as you know, that's one of the things we're fairly well known for pioneering a lot of new research in.
What does it do?
Well, it changes the amount of variability that people have.
Explain that for the listeners, because they may not understand variability.
Sure. In a healthy person, our heart rate changes with every single heartbeat. And that's fairly new for a lot of people to know that, because it used to be thought not that many years ago, say 20 years ago, that a sign of good health was a steady heart rhythm. In other words, if this, within a single beat, the beats per minute equivalent was, say, 70 beats per minute, you would think that the next one would be near that, 71 or 70 or something like that, and so on, unless we did some exercise, you know, to get our heart rate up. It's exactly the opposite of that. Our heart rate is always varying beat to beat, and it's quite surprising how much variability is going on. But loss of the variability, like if it was the same between each beat, like we used to think was healthy, we now know is one of the best predictors of future fairly serious health problems, including what's called sudden cardiac death.
Now, when the heart rate variability changes, does it also change what's going on within cells, too?
Well, probably. The heart rhythm, this is be a little bit off our topic, but is most of us that have been working with heart rate variability for some time now are coming to look at it, like it's a global kind of indicator of your vitality, your well-being, kind of as a system as a whole. So it's a very important fundamental rhythm. So, and lower variability than it should be for our age is correlated with all, well, not good things, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
In cardiology, it's used to predict, like I was saying, eightfold risk of increased risk of sudden cardiac death, arrhythmias, things like that. It's also correlated with cancer and all-cause mortality, which is a very important finding. Things like that.
And that's what happens when it lowers.
Yes, when it's too low for what it should be.
Because, you know, interestingly enough, when something we know, and I have a housewife vocabulary when it comes to science, but the lower something resonates, the more dense it is, so it would be logical that people would get plaque and stiffer arteries and cancers when it does that, wouldn't it?
Well, it's not so much that they get more plaque and stiffer arteries. It's really showing that the autonomic nervous system is primarily affected in the communication between the heart and the brain.
Okay.
Are the source of heart rate variability.
Now, back to your project.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to get all these machines out there? How is that being done? Do you need people to help do that?
We will. Right now, we've got we're developing all the infrastructure, you know, how these sensors are going to talk back to the central lab, and that type of thing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I saw an email or something or a memo or something that said that you guys needed volunteers or people to help. What can someone help do for you?
Well, at this point, it's not so much that we need volunteers to help. We really need to get the project funded at this point, so that would be one way that people could certainly help.
Mm-hmm.
On the technology side, we've got a pretty good team already in place that's doing the work. And we've got sensors that we're testing here, and we've been monitoring the Earth's field for a few months now, 24/7. And the next step is to get several remote sites up and running so we can do the experiments we need to do for triangulation experiments and that type of thing.
So do you have any feedback yet from the information that you have?
Well, we certainly know that we've got... the new design of the sensors is working and working very well, and that we're able to measure all these frequencies. So the next step is really getting a global network of them, and we estimate that it'll take around 100 sensing stations around the globe to do that.
Have you talked to any of, like, the U.S. officials or anybody? Are they open to this and interested in it?
I haven't a clue. No, we haven't talked to any government officials.
It'll be interesting to see what they have to say about it.
I suspect it would be the kind of thing they would probably prefer we didn't do.
No. So, can you tell from this thing how mass consciousness and individual consciousness, can you measure both of those things?
But not necessarily individual, and that's where I was going next, so good question. So, I was just talking about all the work that's already been done. We already know that changes in the Earth's field affect humans on a mass scale, right? Like with the heart attacks and
mm-hmm.
the heart rhythms and that type of thing. So it's really not that difficult to conceive, that here we are living within the field, right? We're embedded within the Earth's magnetic field, and that we would be affected by modulations in these complex fields, right? So that's not that far-reaching. But it's a much more far-reaching proposition to suggest that the Earth's field can be influenced or modulated by human emotions. And that's exactly what we're suggesting and our main reason for developing this global system. And that's why we call it the Global Coherence Monitoring System. So
yeah.
When a global event evokes a negative emotional response, you can think of that as producing a planetary stress wave.
Right? Like when 9/11 happened, everybody got
exactly
depressed.
And there's great data showing that that's exactly what happened, that there was truly a planetary stress wave. You know, I can describe some of that data to you a little bit later if you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
But conversely, what we're proposing here is that a mass positive emotional response can create a global coherence wave. And that if we get enough people into their own personal coherence at the same time with the same intention, we can start offsetting the global stress waves and help starting the process of shifting the planet into global coherence rather than incoherence.
Now, well, Dean Radin and I had a conversation one time about this kind of mass intention.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me a story like if you had a pond and you had 1,000 people around and each person had a pebble.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody threw them randomly, you'd get a bunch of splashes. But
exactly.
If everybody threw it with the same force, the same size, and exactly the same time to the millisecond, all the water would come out. So will it matter how that intention is placed out? I mean, do we have to have a very short, focused intention, or can we just think a good thing?
Well, thinking, from my way of thinking and what our research shows, that thinking is not going to have that much of an impact. It's really emotionality. It's really the feelings that we carry or that we're feeling that create the much stronger waves. And I do think of emotional experiences as generating a literal wave that does interact with the magnetic systems. And there's a lot of evidence for that. And that's the whole other topic that we've been able to show. I mean, for example, you can measure one person's heartbeat and another person's brainwaves quite a few feet away. So our nervous systems are exquisitely sensitive at detecting these emotional fields.
Interesting.
That ride on the heartbeat.
Now, I have a question here. Do you know about Bill Tiller's discovery of magnetic monopoles?
Well, I know that's his theory, yes. It's not necessarily a discovery.
Would what happened... That's me and my linguistic problem again, sorry.
Okay.
Would what happens possibly have something to do with magnetic monopoles?
It's certainly possible.
Do you have the magnetic brief field theory on that?
I'm sorry?
Could you quickly think up how that might play together?
Well, I think that'd be a better question for Bill in terms of it being a magnetic monopole or not. But I can certainly say that magnetic fields, whether they're monopoles or not, seem to be a key to so many things in terms of mediating the kind of effects we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. So, how would this have to do with the Schumann resonance?
Well, the Schumann resonance, okay, this is the Schumann, that name Schumann, doctor was a German physicist who was the first to propose and measure that there were oscillations that occurred in the Earth's atmosphere. And he really meant the broad range of them like I'm talking about. What has happened in, over however many years, is people being enamored with the brain and brain waves and all that. There is a very narrow bandwidth within the IMB's resonances that we're talking about that do fall in the human brainwave region. And those of what are more commonly now become known as the Schumann resonances.
Okay, good.
But it's actually one of the weaker resonances going on. It's a much richer and more complex, it's a sympathy of frequencies that go in all the way up into, say, hundreds of hertz, but that's just one narrow band.
If you wouldn't mind, if there's a human individual consciousness, we know that. You know, we all have our individual consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And then this mass consciousness, just would the individual consciousness, would you suspect that it would be at a higher resonance or a lower resonance than the mass?
That, I don't quite understand your question.
I know, and I wish I had the vocabulary to say it right. If the human individual consciousness, it's got to resonate some frequency between some range, it's got to, I mean, or however it exists. So that would be at one place. And then the mass consciousness, it's got to vibrate at a different level or else it would be the same as the individual consciousness. So would mass consciousness be a higher...
Okay, I think I get at what you're saying.
Thank you.
Here's another way of thinking about that, is that what you would call the kind of standard background consciousness level, okay, or awareness level is another way of thinking about that, which here at HeartMath we call right now, in terms of the global consciousness, what we call 3D. 3D consciousness. So that is the kind of the average of the mass consciousness. In other words, all the individuals, that would be the kind of the where it's resonating at. Now, of course, there are individuals who have more awareness
mm-hmm.
than others, right? So they would kind of be on the other, you could think of it as the far right of the bell curve, if you wanted to look at it that way, at a higher vibration, which would have a higher vibration rate, certainly, but of an increased awareness level.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Would it vibrate at a higher, the more aware someone would be, would it make them be higher than the mass consciousness?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Right.
So a higher frequency. Is that the right word?
And that's what the planetary shift that we're helping to, that our mission is to help facilitate, is really all about, is moving the baseline of the mass consciousness to an increased level of awareness or a higher consciousness.
How do we go about facilitating that and get it so that everybody does it?
Well, there are a number of ways. It's not just one, and the Global Coherence Project we're describing here is one of those ways of being able to measure and show that when groups of people do get into individual coherence, and we can measure that with devices like the M-Wave, which you're aware of, used to be called the freeze framework, that measure your heart rhythm coherence.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're proposing is people, when they do these mass type experiments, if they get into individual coherence first, then they can sync up and have far more effectiveness than if we're just all, you know, off doing our different kind of things. We're, you know, well, we're not really coherent at the individual level would be another way of saying
mm-hmm.
that.
And when Gabby sent me the information about this interview, she said, "I don't have much, Eva. Here's all I have." So I've asked you about the things that I know about and some of the things that she didn't mention. What else do you have to say to us that I don't know to ask the question?
Okay. Well, I was starting to explain that we're proposing that it's a two-way street, that not only we are affected by the fields, we also affect them. Now, the fact that there is a global stress wave, and you said, you mentioned you've already talked with Dean Radin, and I know you're aware of the Global Consciousness Project,
mm-hmm.
which is in some ways similar in concept to what we're talking about here, where they have a network around the globe of random number generators. And what the work there has shown is that it doesn't necessarily work very well with an individual, but when you get large groups of people having a common emotional experience, the random number generators stop being random, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, 9/11 is a great example of that, some of the strongest data yet on it.
If you don't mind, if you would just elaborate just a second for people that don't know what we're talking about.
Sure. A random number generator is basically an electronic device that just spews out, you would say, random noise. There's no pattern in it that can be detected.
Like white noise.
Yeah, kind of like white noise. Or like when you turn a TV on the snow.
Mm-hmm.
On the old TVs, anyway, I guess they don't do that anymore. But so it would be, you could imagine that if you had the old TVs with the white background snow turned on, and it suddenly, when you had an emotional response, there was some type of pattern that showed up on the screen. That's kind of what's happening. When we say that a random number generator stops being random, it means that there's pattern now being introduced into it. And from my own way of thinking, basically, they're these electronic devices, which are a transistor junction or a diode junction, ultimately, what it gets down to, are right at the interface between what people like to call the quantum domain and where we can measure. So if there's a type of coherence that gets introduced in at the quantum level, it bleeds over into these electronic devices. They stop being random, so you see that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So on the 9/11, there was a huge effect across, but what's important, not just in a single detector like in New York, the effect was in all the random number generators around the entire globe. So that's why we can really say it's a global stress wave that occurred. And what's truly amazing in this case, the change where they stopped being random started occurring about 4 hours before the first attack. So it also shows kind of a mass intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a lot of people's experience, too, that I've talked to. They woke up that morning and just didn't feel right. Something was off. Didn't know what it was, but had that feeling.
Yeah, with the random event generators, they can't tell where it's going to happen, though, can they?
No. They just respond to large emotion.
With your new equipment, will you be able to tell where something's going to happen?
Well, we think we will in terms of earthquakes and that type of a thing. Don't know.
It'll be interesting to see if something like if something's going to happen like 9/11, if your machines get coherent in the area where it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now this is a little different, because what we're proposing here is not measuring the output of random number generators, but actually directly measuring the Earth's magnetic field. It's our belief, and Elizabeth's and a few of us here, our intuitions, I guess you could say, that the Earth's magnetic field will be the magnetic domain in general will be a more sensitive and direct measurement system.
Mm-hmm.
And we started this this project and discovered something later that is truly fascinating. And this is one of those things, I wish you could see a picture of it. And it turns out there are two satellites that are designed to measure space weather. that are geosynchronous orbit. So they're 24,000 miles out. It's one on each side of the planet. Okay, 24,000 miles out in each direction. And one of the sensors on them is a magnetic field sensor. And if you look at there's a bit of a, you know, what's called a circadian rhythm, kind of a sine wave-like pattern over a 24-hour period. And if you look in the days coming up to 9/11, you know, the 5 or 6 days prior to it, there's this nice kind of sine wave pattern. And right at the time of the 9/11 attacks, there's a huge spike and a very incoherent-looking pattern starting to emerge in the Earth's magnetic field.
Now, is this just before it or while it's happening?
Good question. We're not really sure until we get a little bit better data here, because this is after the fact, and we only get a certain resolution, so I can't really answer that yet. That's one of the things we're working on, is trying to get the raw data instead of just the 24-hour kind of pictures of it. But you can certainly see that right at, it's almost spooky, but at the time when you lay it over, how this jumps up. We can't tell in terms of whether it was a few minutes, you know, or hour or not, because it's a 24 hours is in a very small space. Then what you see is in the days after 9/11, the Earth's field, it is very incoherent and erratic and just all over the place.
That's
so there's actually some pretty good evidence. I mean, it, you know, a measurement of one thing like this doesn't prove anything, but it's pretty amazing the correlation that we're seeing here.
Have you talked with Henry Stapp about this?
I haven't.
Because I'm wondering how, you know, he acknowledges that something very minuscule happened with Bob John's work and those with the random event generators or whatever the thing Bob did. But he doesn't think that it tells us anything. He just kind of thinks that it's random and, you know, it's unmeaningful. And I don't understand how he can think that when
yeah, I don't either. Well, I mean, I can understand on one level, they're not very sensitive, and it takes big events like a 9/11 or another place that they had good effects was on the Millennium New Year's night. It was another time that there was good measurable effects.
What was that like? I didn't hear about that.
Well, it's the same thing. At midnight in each time zone, there was the random number generators went out of random, stronger in the local time zone, but at the same time there was a worldwide effect, and you could watch it march right around the planet.
That's amazing.
As everybody was celebrating.
That's amazing.
But it was, you know, that was a special big deal on the Millennium, right? There were huge parties and whole countries, you know, involved.
So it's not just bad stuff that measures. It measures good feelings too.
Yeah, it's emotionality.
Uh-huh. So what else do you have to tell us that I don't know to ask you?
Well, that's, I think, probably, I mean, we could talk about a lot of things, but the global coherence thing is the main thing we were wanting to talk about tonight.
I mean, what else about that can you tell us that I don't know to ask you the question?
Sure.
Well, normally I have a big book to read about something. You know?
Well, again, the purpose, there's a number of purposes. One is to verify the degree to which we can detect earthquakes and volcanoes, but instead of doing it on a local scale like Elizabeth was done in the past, do it on a global scale. So imagine being able to go to a website and look at, you know, another way of thinking of this, Eva, that I didn't mention, is you can think of what we're doing as measuring the brain waves and heartbeat of the planet Earth. I mean, that's metaphor, but not really metaphor either.
It's just amazing.
You know, and if you buy into the Gaia kind of ideas, you know, that the Earth is a living being, and we're like cells within it, it makes perfect sense.
Well, that was my next question. What is this telling people?
Well, it's telling us that we are more interconnected in more fundamental ways than we ever thought before. And what we do at the individual level, whether we take what we call energetic self-responsibility and really manage our emotions and learn to recognize the types of emotions that drain our system and lead us into incoherence, but learning how to recognize those and shift those, take responsibility, and choose to run more coherent. feelings and emotions through our system. It takes us into coherence and renews our system. As more and more people do that, that's what starts creating the momentum shift from planetary incoherence to coherence. Then if that interacts with and modulates the Earth's field, like there's good evidence already that we've talked about that in fact does happen, instead of permeating the planet with stress waves, which then all the other people feel, even if they weren't involved, even if you don't watch the news, they still affect you. Your nervous system still detects them, which is why a lot of people feel sort of out of sync. You know, you hear people talking about it all the time now, many different ways and examples of that. So the goal here is to get more and more people into coherence, which then that creates the coherence waves.
Now, you're I can't think of what you call that machine, but the machine that you have that helps people learn how to get in heart coherent.
Right, the M-wave.
You know, we behave the way we do a lot because of conditioning in our lives. And so then we have to, people get on antidepressants to change this level or that level. Or you don't have to get on those things, do you? I mean, if you learn how to train your mind with something like this machine, you can override those conditioned experiences, can't you?
Well, in many cases, absolutely. I mean, there's several versions of the M-wave, and that doesn't really matter now, but I can certainly tell you that thousands, many thousands of healthcare professionals are using the M-wave and what we call the HeartMath tools, the emotional refocusing and restructuring tools, to help people overcome, you know, anxiety, depression, eating disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, working with many of those over 30 military hospitals and VAs now using it with returning soldiers to help them deal with reintegration issues. I mean, the list goes on and on to do exactly what you're saying.
And how does somebody get one of those things?
The easiest way is to go to the HeartMath website, either heartmath.org or heartmath.com, either one. The .org site has more of the research-type related stuff and programs for kids for helping them with taking tests or dealing with anxiety issues around school things and getting better grades, better test performance. I have a number of programs, which is the nonprofit, heartmath.org, and heartmath.com is where you would go for programs for healthcare professionals or consumers that just want to get one of the books to learn about the HeartMath tools or the M-Waves. Well, actually, you can go to either site for the books.
And it's less than $300 to get one of these things? You just plug it into your computer, right?
Yeah, well, there's two versions. There's what's called the M-Wave PC, which means it works with a PC, and you plug that into the USB port on your computer, and it shows you your actual heart rhythms, your heart rate variability we were talking about earlier in real time. And allows you to see for yourself how you're changing emotions just instantly and dramatically affect your heart rhythm patterns. And our heart is basically reflecting, it's beating out our feelings. And then trains you how to shift into a coherent state. And then once you do that, it's got games you can play that are real fun games, and some really neat things in there that are all controlled by your coherence level. Then there's also what's called the M-Wave Personal Stress Reliever. And that's a handheld device, about like the size of an iPod or a small cell phone, that is portable. You don't have to plug it into a computer. And that's under $200 for that one. And so that's being used by lots of professional golfers. So, I mean, just everyone you can think of. For example, Duke University, Duke Hospital System is training all their nurses and giving them all M-Waves right now.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's going on.
Now, I have another question here. I just got through reading iSeen's little magazine that comes out, and they interview Elizabeth Rauscher. You know, you and I have talked a million times about the stochastic resonance and that, what's the word? You know, how we talk about that signaling that goes out, the rat-a-tat-tats, remember that? What will this work that y'all are doing now, how does it relate to that and learning how that resonance, what do you call that, signaling?
You're talking about stochastic resonance?
Yes. And the signaling that the heart sends to the brain, that impulse, what do you call that impulse?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, when the heart, every time the heart beats, it sends just all kinds of complex information up through the nervous system to the brain, through the autonomic nervous system.
Uh-huh. Is there a word for that?
Well, it's called afferent.
Okay, that thing.
Yeah.
How will you be able to learn what someone's afferent signal means as it relates to certain illnesses? Does that make sense?
Well, kind of. We can already trace the afferent just means ascending, going to. So, I mean, neural messages going from the heart to the brain. And that may sound strange to some people listening, but that's been known since the late 1800s. What is surprising to a lot of people to learn is that the heart sends far more information to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. We've just been so focused on the brain age that we've really forgotten the big picture.
Yeah, I think the people think that the brain's in charge of everything, but it just interprets, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, we're finding that the new models and the new understanding of how of emotionality, most people associate emotion with the heart and have for centuries. Every major culture on the planet does that naturally. They've been right all along. So it is the signals that the heart is sending to the brain that has a lot to do with what we're feeling, literally, not just metaphorically. And so the brain is interpreting those signals.
Since it's sending all of those signals, let's say that, for instance, I got mad right now for some reason. This heart's going to send a signal to my brain. How would you, would measuring that ever be possible?
Well, it's possible now.
They can interpret the signal?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, and in fact, the M waves, in a way, are doing that, are measuring that, because that's the heart rhythm.
So they can eventually. You should be able to find a certain signal in someone and say, "Uh-oh, that signal means you're going to get a heart disease." Or
well, not so much that from the afferent type stuff we're talking about between the heart and the brain, and it's both the heart and the brain. They're wired together very uniquely and strongly together, more so than any other gland or organ systems in the body. The heart and the brain are. When we're talking about predicting disease, that's different than when we're talking about emotional experience. We already know that our emotions are reflected in our heart rhythm patterns. So we can measure your heart rhythm, which is what the M-wave does, and the different patterns that are beat out that you see right on the screen are reflective of your emotional state, what you're feeling, not what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, somebody can tell you they're thinking one thing, but you see right on the screen that they're feeling something entirely different.
That's amazing. So we've got about 15 minutes. Can you tell us a little bit about your other projects you're working on?
Sure. One of the projects we just completed was called the Test Edge National Demonstration Study. This was a huge study that was funded by the U.S. Department of Education. And this was looking at several things. One is, what's the relationship between you could think of them as emotional blocks, the kind of mind jammers, things like anxiety and peer issues, teenagers have all their identity at,
mm-hmm.
and all their emotional energy going, how that affects academic performance. So this was a large multi-site study, and actually there were schools in 8 states involved in it.
And what did you do?
Well, the main part of the study focused on 10th grade students. Because here in California, that's the first year they have to take high school exit exams when they start taking their high-stakes tests. And we looked at a lot of different elements of these students' emotional lives. Certainly their test anxiety, but also their relationships, how many friends they had, and the quality of relationships, and things of that nature. And one of the things we found, well, first of all, it hasn't been a study that really addressed what's the magnitude of the problem in terms of test anxiety, for example, which is one of the things we focused on again. And the numbers from previous studies before No Child Left Behind, were all over the map, and people used different measurements and different types of students and things. And what we found floored me. I did not expect it. We found that 61% of these high school kids, these 10th graders, are suffering from high levels of test anxiety, 61%. And I just didn't think it would be that high, but that is, in fact, the level of that's going on. And one in four, 26% actually, are suffering high levels. In other words, the type of anxiety that would really interfere with the test ability to accurately measure their ability. The anxiety gets in the way in a significant way.
I wouldn't have thought that either.
Yeah, I wouldn't have.
I would have thought they didn't care.
Exactly. Well, that was my reason for thinking it'd be less, too, because also we found that students are, for a lot of students, not all, are really disengaged from the educational process. They're there because they like hanging out with their friends.
Right.
Now, the students with the high level, the 61% with high anxiety, the ones with higher anxiety scored about 15 points on average lower in math and reading than the kids with, you know, normal or low levels of anxiety, test anxiety. And 15 points, that's enough to, you know, if you're right on the end of the bubble, to whether you pass or fail, whether you get your high school exit certificate or not.
So what happened when... Did you use your equipment?
Yeah, so what we did, there was an intervention component that was taught in the classrooms and actually in English classes two times a week for 20 minutes over a three-month period called Test Edge, which basically taught the students the emotional refocusing techniques and emotional shifting techniques. In other words, when you're starting to feel anxiety or you're starting to get angry at your parents or, you know, a sibling or brother or sister or whatever, these techniques that you use, like freeze frame, which is a technique that basically has you focus in the area of your heart and breathe through the area of the heart to help get your energies pulled out of the area of the heart, then shift your emotions to activate a positive feeling, like a feeling of appreciation, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is to feel the positive feeling, not to just think about it or visualize it. And then they installed the M-waves in the computer labs in the school so the students could practice and see it for themselves when they were in coherence or not. And the kids really liked the M-waves. They really took to them.
So if you've got one of those M-wave machines at home or the other little small thing, how do you see your results?
Well,
on the small machine.
On the small one, you see it on, there's a light that's either red, blue, or green. So red means you're not in coherence. Blue means medium coherence, and green means high coherence.
Okay. The one that you get at home, though, shows you a graph or something?
Yeah, you actually, on the one at home, on the computer screen, you actually see your heart rhythm going across the screen. And then it also has the red, blue, green coherence levels. The main advantage of the one that you plug into the computer is it has the games that you can play.
How much is that?
That's $295, I believe.
What a deal.
Oh, it really is, yeah.
So what else are you working on, or have you worked on?
Well, let me finish that study, because the intervention had huge effects. In other words, the level of anxiety was dropped significantly, and this is looking at the entire 10th grade population. But then when we matched the students so they had equal 9th grade test scores, so we had them academically matched, most of the groups had significant jumps in their actual test scores. Was an amazing finding.
Absolutely. And no extra studying, just calming down.
Yeah, no, it was just giving them the tools to learn how to become coherent.
How long did that take?
Well, the intervention was, let's say, two times a week for 20 minutes over a three-month period.
So that's amazing, Rowan.
I'm sorry?
That's amazing.
It really was, yeah. So that study is just we'll just be releasing the report on that. Probably in the next couple of weeks, a 280-some-page report. It's a pretty massive study. There was just lots of jewels in it. We also found that test anxiety isn't the biggest issue blocking their performance. It's really the wider range, but it is clearly emotional issues. It's the lack, and the students were very clear about this, that they really weren't taught tools and didn't really know that they could self-regulate and choose what they're feeling. And they really appreciated learning that not only they can do that, but how to.
I don't think the schools really know about it or understand. I went to my child's school not too long ago and talked to the science class, and the science teacher had no clue about what we were talking about.
Well, that's true of people in general. For the most part, you know, we're taught, and whether it's in church or wherever it is, that it's and kind of common sense. It feels better if we're in a positive state, right? You know, we teach our kids to say thank you, you know, appreciation, have gratitude, and things like that. But it's usually just more of a mental concept.
Words, right.
Yeah, and not really taught that we really can regulate our emotions, that we really do have choice.
Now, have you done some collaborative work, maybe with somebody like Candace Pert or someone to see how the change in the chemical neurotransmitter release is affected?
I haven't done it with Candace Pert. We do have, there are actually about, probably close to 30 studies that are either going on right now or will be started in the near future and involving different aspects of heart mass and different parts. And one of those is a collaborative study. We're partnering with the Arizona State University. And they have it with their a lab that's a very well-known hormone measurement lab that measures all the different biochemistry and hormones and things. So we're going to be measuring things like oxytocin, neuropeptide Y, some of the more exotic stuff in that study.
Do you know Gottfried Kellermann?
I don't.
He's at, you ought to look this up sometimes. He's at Neurosciences, Inc. I think the website may be neurorelief.com. I had him on my show a while back, and that's his life, is neurotransmitters, and he was conscious, and he was so interested in what you were doing. You two ought to connect up.
I'd love
about
to.
You. And he would really like to do some kind of research like that.
Yeah, you should send me his email.
I will do that.
Yeah, I'd love to. Maybe just send us both one and say, hey, my way of introduction kind of thing.
I'll do that because
okay,
he was when I told him about you, he was like, oh, I really want to meet those. And then we kind of forgot to make it happen. Remember when I came out there, I've been dying to ask you, why are you asking me the questions? What were you doing? What kind of research were you doing?
I don't know.
You were asking me about, one of the questions was about what happens to plants if you stick them into an electrical socket and...
Oh, some of those questions. Yeah, you following up on a lot of Cleve Baxter's work on measuring plants and looking to find ways to make that a more practical and easy thing to do. That is what those questions were about.
Oh, okay. So what happened with that research?
We're still doing it.
Tell me about it. I'm just so interested in everything you're doing.
Yeah, well, when we were talking earlier about, I was talking about how emotions are very real, literal fields. But they're a type of field. We don't have scientific instruments that will measure directly the field like we do electric fields and magnetic fields. But they're the types of, I guess you could call them sensors, are biological systems. So like plants and cells and things like that are definitely tuned into these types of emotions, which is what Cleve Baxter's work has shown.
Can you tell us a little for people that don't know?
Cleve Baxter, usually the reference that'll make people, that most people will remember or be able to relate is the book Secret Life of Plants. That was popular. What was it back in the 70s or 80s? I don't remember now. A very popular book. That was all based on Cleve Baxter's work. He was the first guy to do this. And Cleve's an interesting, very interesting guy. He was literally the fellow who worked out the protocols and invented the lie detector test, polygraph, which is still used today, the protocols he worked out. So he had the idea of, why don't I hook up my equipment to a plant? And he did and found that the plants were sensitive to human emotion. In fact, when somebody, he found, Cleve off and, talking to him alone, not necessarily alone, but some of the things he used to do, he'd have a plant hooked up when he was doing light detector stuff, and the plant was just as accurate, if not more accurate, at responding when a person was lying than, all the instrumentation.
Really? What did it do?
Well, during especially negative-type emotions, or a spontaneous kind of something that doesn't feel good, the plants will react electrically. It's fairly well known in the plant research that plants have electrical signals that travel through them. And it's kind of amazing when we've looked at these, that if I showed you recordings from human nervous system, where we really go in and look at how neurons are talking to each other, action potentials, and recordings from plants, you would not probably be able to tell me which one was which.
Really?
Even though plants obviously don't have the same type of nervous system that humans do, the electrical signaling being used looks almost identical.
Now, what part of the plant does the signaling?
Well, because
it doesn't have a brain like our heart like we do.
Right. So it's the cells and the leaves and the stalks and the roots are also involved in it.
Interesting. Somebody told me one time that the plants also learned by conditioning, that he could do something to them and the first time they would get upset and then they would finally learn that he really wasn't going to hurt them and they would stop getting upset.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that makes it difficult to do rigorous scientific protocols around, where you see this very clear cause and effect, stimulus response, repeatable thing. Well, plants don't work that way. It takes sincere, spontaneous emotion for them to react. So you're exactly right, and we see this happen all the time. Somebody will walk in, and if they don't even know the experiment's going on, or you have a plant hooked up, and you say something that makes them mad or gets them upset, the plants just go crazy. They react. But then if you say, well, get mad at the plant, it doesn't work because it's not real.
It's so interesting. Well, Roland, we've got just about 4 minutes left, and one of the purposes of my show is to kind of bridge the gap between conventional science that's not wanting to listen and the new science, or the super science is what I call it. You've got 4 minutes to tell a potential funder, why this is real and why it's important and why conventional science doesn't always listen and that they should.
Okay, that's a lot to do in 4 minutes. Well, I think what we were talking about earlier would be what if anybody did want to make some donations towards would be, and that is really realizing that we are all interconnected and that the most important thing at the individual level that we as individuals can do is learn to take self-responsibility for our energetic system, as I like to call it, basically our emotions, and to realize that there really are easy to learn and very practical tools that anyone can learn, somebody in kindergarten or a CEO of a big corporation, to learn how to care more, appreciate more, love more, and that those create very real fields that when enough people start doing it, and which is starting to happen, that it really can create a global shift.
And there, just for the scientists out there, because this gets sent to different places, by the way, the science is real, and I would imagine that it's reproducible.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's why we've got that.
And I would imagine that because they don't want to believe it, that it's even more rigorous than typical studies.
Well, certainly as rigorous, and some of the things like our work on intuition, which I think we talked about last time we was on your show, is extremely rigorous. That's way more so than most studies are done because it's showing when you have results that are, what's the word I'm looking for, almost unbelievable, you've got to go the extra mile to really show that the science is very rigorous.
And where can someone contact you? We've got about a minute left.
Well, heartmath.org would be the place to get me.
And that's HEARTMATH, not
right.
Math.
Exactly. Heart and math.
And your email, if somebody wanted to contact you?
If you go to the website, heartmath.org, then there's info there. That would be a way to get to me.
Well, Roland, thanks so much for coming on. I hope you'll come back again soon, and I'd really like to have Elizabeth come on sometime.
We can arrange that.
I'd love that. And thanks a lot. My show is always open to you.
I appreciate that.
God be my friend, and good night.
Good night.